Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast, coming at you via our brand new YouTube channel. Coming at you like the Italian stallion Robert Rocky Balboa, laying waste to Ivan, death from above, Drago in Moscow on Christmas Day, single-handedly ending the Cold War. If I can change Avalone, and you can change, maybe everybody can change.
Was that the song? I don't. That was a long time ago, man. That was Rocky IV, right? Drago is four.
That was, goddamn right, right, that was Rocky IV. Yeah. I know our guest knows that that was Rocky IV. I think he's going to have some stuff to say about that.
Yeah.
He's fighting Drago in Moscow on Christmas right. Day because the Russians are godless, and he is so inspiring. He comes with the full power of America, and he's so inspiring that the Russians are on their feet at the end, chanting Rocky, 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 and everybody comes together, you know, because of this one man's his will, his determination, his grit, all these like great American things, and he addresses the crowd at the end because they want him to, they need him to, and he says, "If I can change, and you can change, maybe we all can change." And he single-handedly ends the Cold War.
And Boris Yeltsin puts down his vodka, listening in the crowd, and says, "Yeah, right." Slow '80s clap from Boris Yeltsin and Mikhail Gorbachev in the crowd, giving the '80s clap.
There you go.
Well, welcome back to the writer's block, where we talk maybe a little too much about 1980s action movies.
We've already taken a hard left turn off the off the road. Let me do the standard, if you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many more. Our entire catalog can be celebrated via Apple Pods, wherever you get your ear crack. We do have an audio portion, but this is our brand new YouTube channel. This is our second brand new episode here. This is a home for all sorts of great comic content. Now, the Writer's Block is here. You will see classic episodes. You will see sort of a lot of short content, a lot of how-to content. This is your one-stop shop for great comic stuff.
You should subscribe. As of this morning, we had 69 subscribers. And of course, like any child of my generation, I said, nice. When I saw that... But I would like there to be more than 69 subscribers now. That would be nice. So hop on, pay attention, show us the love, and you will be rewarded.
There you go. Ryan,
before we bring our guest on, what do you got going on these days?
What do I have going on, man? I am, we launched this new YouTube channel, also launching the new publishing endeavor. We're going to talk to our guest, Ray Anthony Height, about his new publishing endeavor. I'm going to let my dog in because she is scratching at the door. This is the kind of stuff you get when you're live, is your dog kicks her way into the thing. Half Evil Comics is incorporated. We are acquiring IP properties. I am nice. Finishing some deals right now, so much more to come. The fourth issue of The Jump will be launched on Kickstarter in a couple of weeks as we record this on January 20th. So if you're watching it late, you might want to head over to Kickstarter and see if it's launched. My films State of Consciousness with Emil Hirsch and Haunted Heart with Academy Award-winning director Fernando Trueba and actor Matt Dillon can be seen on all your streaming platforms. That's what I'm up to. What do you got coming out, Avalone?
Issue 7 of Drawing Blood, which is behind me with a beautiful Matt Wagner cover, will be that I posed for. I just like to say I can sit on the floor holding a liquor bottle, and Matt drew that very nicely for me. That'll be out from Image sometime in the next week or so, 2 weeks. At the end of January, I am at Creepy Con in Ontario. The one in Canada. No. The one in the Inland Empire. That's what the IE in Creepy stands for, believe it or not. And I'll be doing that through We Can Be Heroes, are sponsoring me. And at the end of February, I'll be in Long Island for the first annual Long Island Convention of Horror as a guest of horror. In between there, Savage Tales, one shot. number three comes out, which has three stories by me and one by Kurt Busiek in it, which is very nice. A John Carter, a Gulliver of Mars, and a Vampirella. And then I just got asked to write a Red Sonja one-shot that'll be coming out at some point in the future. So that's nice. That. But let us move on to our guest. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Ray Anthony Height. Yo. Welcome, Ray.
I love you guys, man. You guys are great.
Hey, we love you too. As we always do, tell the kids at home briefly a little bit about yourself.
I have bodies buried in places that no one will ever find. And if you find them, you're probably one of them. Let's see. I am Ray Anthony Height. I am the cartoonist, because now I'm a cartoonist, you guys, because I write and draw officially.
That's right.
The cartoonist of Midnight Tiger, and I have spent the last 20 years working for Marvel and recently DC. I've just started I founded my production company, which is now kind of a small press publisher, Studio Sky Tiger LLC. And we are going to be doing a lot of projects that are coming out, mostly my own stuff, like, again, Midnight Tiger Evo, which is going to be on Kickstarter in March, but you can go to the pre-launch and kind of sign up for that. And it's we just did this big rousing thing. I knew it was going to be crazy. So because of Buck Rogers going into the public domain, we have our own Buck Rogers one-shot called A Rise to Ruin, the Buck Rogers Chronicles, Chronicles of Buck Rogers. So, and you guys get that because, you know, he wakes up from suspended animation and the world is in ruin. Aha, A Rise to Ruin. So, so we're doing that. We're in October. We're going to do a one-shot called Zombie Eater, which premiered a two-part kind of like prelude or backstory in Nightmare Theater anthology.
Okay. Oh, nice.
It's coming out. Yeah. So, sure. So yeah, we're gonna, you know, go full with a one shot for a horror release. And Abalone, you are always a guest of horror in my heart. So, So, what else are we gonna do? Of course. I think what else we do? We're doing What the Fuck, Mama, for my beautiful wife, who is the creator. Our company is the art production team. And she's written this hilarious, you know, story about this 85-year-old, you know, matriarch who is fighting tooth and nail and shovel and pick to keep her independence.
Nice.
Too hilarious.
Timely.
Yes, right?
I am interested in this. I mean, you you just rattle off like five great projects. No. But this is where I wanted to go with it, as my dog barrels back through. This is a thing that's happening with very talented creators. I mean, I just talked about, I mean, I just incorporated and I'm acquiring IP and I'm lining up. There are a lot of people, you know, and people who have worked in the standard pipeline for a very long time. And we're all kind of going into business for ourselves now. And
we got smart, Riley.
There you go. And that's where I'm taking it. That's where I'm taking it. So I want to talk about the decision a lot. I've been wanting for a long time to talk about this decision with you, because I think that you and I, and there are a lot of other smart people who are moving this way. I think the business is moving in this direction.
Yes.
And this conversation is probably long overdue, right?
Yeah. Very, very long overdue. I mean, I think all three of us here, we understand the value of owning IP, just period. But the other part of it is, like, for me, my plan is I do 80-20, 80% my stuff, 20% freelance. Mm-hmm. So I, like, they just announced DC Power, Rise of the Power Company, which for the first time I've done DC work. This is the very first time I've ever done superheroes. I'm starting out with the Bat Family. So DC's treating me very, very well, right?
Good.
Very, very good. And DC, you know, thanks to them, they've started to incorporate my studio in, and me, of course, come along with it, into doing projects. So it's, that's not, that's one of, let's see, two or three projects or whatever. I think two projects, possibly three, depending on how things go with a certain yeah. pitch. You know, we're doing stuff for DC. So it's not just Studio Sky Tiger stuff, which is the main thing, which we're, you know, all going through Kickstarter. But my goal is to, anytime, you guys saw my Facebook post, anytime that I'm mentioned online in interviews or whatever, I want my studio name to be associated with the work because it's about the studio. Mm-hmm. And that's how Ryland, like, we're going to get eyes on our stuff.
Yeah.
As we have this conversation on the Half Evil Comics YouTube channel.
Yes, exactly. Branding is everything.
That's the thing. For everyone who does this kind of work, the 20% or, you know, whether for some people it's 50%, for some people it's 70%, that 20% buys you a lot of grace on your 80%. It gets eyes on it. And doing it without that is hard. You can try and you can luck out. You can be Kevin Eastman or Dave Sim and launch something without, like, I drew Batman for 20 years and then I did this.
But the times were different, Dave.
But the times were absolutely different. And yeah. Again, it's like, it's still, it is absolutely hell. You know, it's what Carrie Fisher called your middle name. You know, she said, I used to be Carrie Debbie Reynolds' daughter, Fisher. Then I became Carrie Star Wars Fisher. Then I became Carrie Princess Leia Fisher because it was bigger than yes. Star Wars. And then I get to be just Carrie Fisher because I don't need the middle name anymore. And, you know, getting that first middle name where people go, oh, I know what that is.
Yeah.
You know, that is a helpful thing. People, and people writing press releases, people interviewing you, they want the convenience of saying, this is why you should be interested in this.
Yes. Dude.
He wrote this thing for DC. He wrote this thing for Marvel, etc.
It's a shorthand. What did you tell me on a recent Zoom? What was my middle name?
I can't remember. Was it?
David goes, yeah, you gotta, you know, it sounds great, but you gotta remember your middle name is Marvel. Like Ray and Anthony Marvel. It's a lot of names. Ray, like Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Like,
I've said 100 times. It was like my first Kickstarter was a $15,000 Kickstarter instead of a $3,500 to $5,000 Kickstarter because I was the guy that won a Ringo Award and put a couple of books in comic shops and I'm still dining out on that, and I am very aware that I need to very soon refresh my profile in comic shops and it's been problematic because I'm supposed to have 2 Immortal books in comic shops right now via Dynamite, but there were, you know, some funding twists and turns, and I don't want to get too far into that, but I'm supposed to have that. I was making decisions to have that, but I do not currently have that. And I think that is problematic. And, the 80-20 thing is a great thing to, it's a great way to put it. And what I think is so interesting is that you're right. It's like, well, if you, it's 80% your work. And that 20% really is kind of like fuel for that fire, right? And you know, keeping you in people's minds and whatnot. And you know, I was talking with a really interesting creator. I cannot say the creator's name because it will betray certain confidences. But but he was talking about he has a very high level position at a good publisher that he is going to leave. And he is doing the same thing we're doing. He is tired of working for the man, and he is going to start his own shop. He's focusing on his own work. A lot of people will think he's crazy for doing it, but it is what is going to feed his soul. It is, and he thinks that he's going to make more money doing it, which is a big factor, I think, for all of us in doing this. Is like, you know, it is very hard to make money putting comics in comic book shops, right? A little bit more cut and dried for an artist because you're getting paid a page rate and all that stuff. But if you're just creating the book yourself and delivering it to a publisher who's going to take most of the money, you can make a lot more money, you know, on Kickstarter with you know, a lot fewer.
Well, Ryland, that's one to one. Here's the beauty that you and Avalone have is a writer can write multiple things and make way more money
than
an artist. You know? Yeah. So That, so it's a trade-off. And that's the thing, like, you can't do
convention sketches, though. That's the killer.
And so, right, it's like a little back and forth.
Yeah.
There's give and take on both sides. There's plus and minuses on both sides. Yeah. So,
absolutely.
But people like me are totally greedy because I can do both now.
Yeah.
So, and that's the thing, which I think is funny, because I remember announcing that I was going to write and draw. And it's not like I hadn't been writing before, but people know me for the art. And I would have conversations with certain friends, you know, as we do, I don't want to say behind closed doors, like it's some kind of secret cabal or something, but it's just conversations. But people, any writer that's pissed off that had, and I use the term very lightly, but I have very good friends who are some of the best writers in the business. And when I announced I was doing my own thing, they're like, oh, shit. You know what I mean? Like, this guy. Blame Kevin Grievous for that. Because Kevin Grievous is like, you can write and draw.
Friend of the
you
show.
Should be doing, yeah. You should be doing
who can
that.
Say no to that voice? Like, that's the voice of God.
My Kevin wife Grievous... can say no to that voice. My wife can and has.
Yeah. I've actually said no to Kevin about a couple of things, but he's a very powerful presence.
He is very powerful and a great guy. I love Kevin so much. You know, Kevin is writer on my very first Marvel work.
Interesting.
Know, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Which was
Spider-Man
what?
Family. So yeah.
Oh, okay.
Spider-Man Family issue 8. Hmm. So yeah. Yeah. And Kevin and I have been friends for a while. So, but yeah, I mean, it was great advice. He helped me confidence wise, because we talked about story.
Yeah.
That's if this goes out to both writer and artists. If you're a writer and you look for an artist, you need to figure out what kind of writer you are. Are you a writer who wants to have work for hire as an artist? Like, you want the artist to basically do the visuals and you do all the thinking, you know what I mean? Or is it collaborative? Because you can have an artist who just doesn't want to think, and they're just phenomenal at just depicting what's on paper, right? Mm-hmm. Like what's in the script. They're awesome. They're not sure. They're figuring things out to a certain degree, but if you've written a beautiful scene, all they're doing is doing their interpretation of that scene. But you know, if you know there is an orc that's hiding in a bush, waiting for people to cross a bridge. You know, and that artist draws this beautiful scene. It's a great landscape, and you know, it's a cart, and the people are crossing the bridge. That's great. Artwork looks great, but an artist writer like me, I would add so much stuff. Like, what are they doing? What's the orc doing? What is he wearing? What kind of weapons does he have? Maybe he's ate lunch. There's a body on the side of it. I don't know. Yeah. I'm what I'm doing is I'm trying to flesh out the scene even more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking further, because that's why I love working with writers who tell me about the character and less about the scene. Because I can build the scene based on the character. Right? So there's a difference. And I think that there are artists who are brilliant, but they've never ventured out to start their own thing. They work with brilliant writers though, and they kick ass and they make a great team. And so figure out what you want. If you want a true collaborator, you want an artist who thinks, like who has ideas. All artists think. I'm not, you know, they all think, but you want somebody who has ideas, who is additive, not just, you know, the person to flesh it out, so.
Yeah, there is this balance on it. I mean, it's like I you know, be careful what you wish for sometimes, but it's like I desperately want somebody to come in and elevate my stuff. You know, it's a revision. It's like having a great editor in film, right? Where it's like, well, you write a good script, you go and you capture the movie, and then there was another revision or 10 that happens in the editing room. And if you have a great editor and they're going to see things you didn't, and they're going to simplify things, and they're going to build some things out, and they're going to make this moment and that moment, and oh, wow, this actor is really bringing it. So let's spend a little more time with this actor than this other one that needs a little help. That's an interesting thing. I mean, what I find sometimes with artists, I there's nothing I love more than when an artist is going to argue with me over something like, hey, this thing that you did here, I want to, because here's the thing is like, you get into a great relationship with somebody, you know, a great collaborator. And I don't give them a script I don't think is good or right. And that's not to mean that there's not room for them to, like you're talking about, let's build it out, let's flesh it out. But you know, I have made certain decisions, but what I find is that so they learn, well, first of all, there's not that much here to take issue with. However, if I do take issue with something, I better have my shit together, because he's gonna ask me these questions. He did not give me this arbitrarily. He made this decision for a very specific reason, and he's going to come back at it. So when they're like, hey, I don't know about the bridge here, and it's like, well, here's why I did the bridge. Here are the five reasons I gave you the bridge. Right. And sometimes that's all it takes is like, well, I did the bridge for this reason. It's like, oh, I see that. Okay, now I know how to draw it because you showed me what you were thinking. However, a lot of times if they push back, 95% of the time that they push back, they are correct. You know what I'm saying? When somebody pushes back on that, I have learned to listen, because it's like, okay, well, they see something. Well, not every artist is, you've been doing it forever, right? So you are confident, you are assertive. If you're going to push back on me, you're going to have your 10 reasons and we're going to come. Not every artist has that in them. They have to learn that sometimes, where it's like, okay, well, convince me. I'm for it. Convince me why the bridge isn't the right thing. And sometimes I have to drag it out of them, because it's like, okay, well, they're seeing something. This is an artist that I love, that I trust. I'm going to pull convincing me out of them. Because 95% of the time when they trip over something like that, they're right. But what I encounter and what I think is kind of the trouble of the business is, like, a lot of times these guys are so busy. I know, like, the artist I'm working with in Brazil, he has some monetary issues and he needs to blow through pages. And so a lot of times he does not have the time.
Yeah.
He does not have the bandwidth to do the stuff you're talking about, where it's like, so sometimes I feel like he would give me the most brilliant page ever if time was not an issue.
Yeah. And some guys are just looking for the check, you know. Yeah. They will depict exactly what you say.
Yeah.
And then as the writer who really gives a crap about what they've written, and you get back exactly what you wrote, and you're like, this is what I said, but yeah. Right? Haven't you guys had that before? Where this is what I said. And Evelyn's told me something, like, you had an artist, I think, on Elvira, and the artist completely, like, uplifted what you wrote. Like, added, right?
Probably that's talking about Sylvia putting that background jokes in Elvira in Horrorland. Elvira.
I loved that.
Yeah, Elvira in Horrorland. She... Every time there was an opportunity for an extra joke, she would do it. And look, though, I will say, I have worked with artists, not just because they're busy. There are the scourge for me is I've worked with artists, and I will not name any names, who clearly did not read the script.
Yes.
Like, you get the page
that's
back.
That's the worst.
If you read the panel description, it'll tell you why there has to be a, you know, object X actually has to be visible in the frame, or the page makes no sense.
Yeah. Per the script.
You know, it's right there, man. I actually gave you that information. And also, I've had the thing where you have to be extra careful, because I know a lot of not a lot, but I know there are artists who deal with what's in front of them, and they won't read the whole script or absorb it before they start drawing. And they'll draw something on page 3, and you're like, you know, that doesn't work if you've read page 4, but you haven't, you're not looking at page 4. So I've gotten a little better about, like, being really clear in some scripts. And, you know, I've had artists, issue 9 of Drawing Blood, Ben Bishop came up with an overall approach to the whole issue that is not in my script. Yeah. And it makes fitting the dialogue that I had planned into this panel or that panel awkward in some places, but I adjusted for him because it was a great idea.
That's what you want.
The main character is in rehab and basically is institutionalized, and basically he designed it so that the character is sort of trapped in a pattern on every page until he's freed.
That's hilarious.
And it's just something in the, it's not an obvious thing. It's not like there are bars in every shot. It's just like, there's a pattern, there's six panel, like every page is a certain way until you get to a certain point. And when he explained that to me, I went, okay, that's really thoughtful. And I hadn't realized you were doing that. So I'm going to not say, no, 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 put it back the way it was in the script. And you do have to be open to that. But there are times the artist just simply gets it wrong. And and I always, when I'm working with someone new, it's tricky because this can make it sound like I'm a control freak and I have to explain to them why I'm asking. When I say, I want to see every page, layouts, pencils, inks, as you finish them before you move on to a new page, like, or as you move on to a new page. And it's like, it's not because it needs to be perfectly my thing. It's because I want to stop you before you do something and I'm going to have to make you change it when it's in inks. Like, it's actually all about me. Yeah, I just care that the story is being told and that the story elements are there. And in a layout, you can go, oh, you know, panel five, I need to see the car in the background of panel five to set up what happens on page six. And they go, oh, great, I'll put the car in the background of panel five. Like, it's like, but I don't want to have to tell you that, like, when you inked it already. I want to tell you that when it's in layouts and you can fix it now rather than when it's way more work to fix it.
David, that's what I teach. In the studio, I teach this to my crew.
Good.
It is the three step when you get the script before you draw anything. You read the whole script. Okay? You read it to get the whole story.
Right.
Before you draw a single thing, absorb it. I use the term, and I'm giving bits and pieces of my class for free here, so I hope people tune in. I hope they tune in. But it's like, see the movie. Read the script, see the movie, see the show, whatever, however you see it in your mind's eye. Understand what these characters are doing, you know, the whole thing. Then you do your second pass. The second pass is you make notes based on you seeing the movie, right? So you go through each page, okay, this, because now you know everything in sequence. Now you know, if you're really good and the writer is really good, you know everyone's motivation. And then that is how you get a really cohesive story. Then you start doing the layout. So three, you read it again and you do thumbnails. I usually do thumbnails right on the script. So I know from what to what, and sometimes it's a shot, maybe it's the key shot. So really the third pass is finding the key shot for each thing and building the page around it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And once you do that, then you can go ahead and do the layouts. But as once you understand, if you have any questions, all that in three passes, if you have a question, talk to your writer.
Yes.
You should be talking to them anyway.
Yeah.
Right. That's just
there what are, you're you know, to do. When you're working, I'm sure you know this, Ray, when you're working sometimes for a company.
Oh, God.
Thank God Dynamite doesn't do this to me. There's a gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. There's an editor. And, you know, when I started out, no one really told me how to do this stuff. And on my first comic, I was like, I'm going to email the artist directly. Right. Like we're going to have a conversation about that. But I've had situations where they're like, no, you submit the script and then 20 days later you get to see a finished inks. And I'm like, that's too late. Like that is too late to fix a lot of things. Cause I don't want to be the guy going back and saying, you got to redraw this whole page, man. It sucks. You know, and I gotta rewrite shit to make it fit. And, you know, one of the things I try to tell people when they have that immediate, what do you mean you want to see every layout before I get started? I always tell them, look, dude, 99% of my replies, ask any artist I've worked with, are going to be, looks great, man. Like 1 out of 100 times I'm going to say I need the car in the background on panel five on page six. But 99% of the time, my email and reply is going to be, looks great, man. And that's it. Or
and it's good to receive those emails, yeah. right? You know, a little
that's the thing. That's the other thing. Is like, don't you want me going, yeah. go man, go every page?
Yeah.
Like, don't
right?
Don't
you should
want me yeah. behind yeah. you 100%
and on or, your side. Or if they do something in the layout and you're like, oh, I didn't see it that way. Hey, can we do blah blah blah? Right?
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
changes the whole course. And then a character who is supposed to be depressed, but keeping it inside the entire time for the whole story, right? He's stoic yep. on the outside, but depressed. And then this person starts everywhere they go. Let's say there's a black crow that follows them. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And you're like, hey, I noticed in the layouts, here's this black crow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you're like, oh man, I get that. Cause that's like, yeah. you know, representation. Come on. You know what yeah. I mean? Like it's things like that,
yeah.
that,
yeah.
if you don't read the damn script, if yeah. you don't get the characters, if you don't understand people's motivations, you're not going to get that. You're
yeah. We're both telling the story. When you're making a movie, the DP has to, yes. the cameraman yeah. has to understand the movie you're making.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
has to make the same yeah. movie you are.
Well, and it's all a give and take too. It's not
actors
too. Yeah. I mean, you don't stand on opposite sides of the set for 60 days, you know, yeah. it is DP sets up a shot and you're like, this fucking shot is awesome. Like this low angle is incredible. It does this, yes. this, and this for us. And the DP is like, you know what? Like we have two scenes coming up next week where like, you know, if we did a low angle here and a low angle there, that would be the, yes. and without that exchange, you never get the two other great shots. There's no feedback yes. from the low angle shot. It's like, it's just like, here's the thing. DP goes off, shoots the entire movie. And then, and then you meet the DP in the, the dailies room or something like that. And it's like, oh, you know, that low angle shot is great. We should have done more of those.
Yes.
Oh, and look, you know,
yeah.
the thing about all collaborative art forms is you never know. You don't know who had what great idea. And the real ones are the ones who say, oh, that was the penciler's idea. Oh, that was the yeah. letterer, actually. Yeah. One of the best jokes in The Shape of Elvira came from Taylor Esposito, the letterer. Mm. And he's never suggested a line of dialogue ever. But the one time he did, it was the gag in that very quickly is that it's Elvira. It's called The Shape of Elvira. Elvira is hired to star in a movie that is essentially The Shape of Water. And the secret is that the director, the star of the movie is an actual Brazilian river monster, not an actor in makeup. And he's trying to mate them together to create a super race of gill people, whatever. But okay. At a certain...
Solid.
She's told by the director, your leading man is very method and you're never going to see him out of the costume. And he's always going to talk with that weird voice. And she speculates logically that her very method leading man must be Christian Bale or Daniel Day-Lewis or, you know, whoever it is. And there's a scene where a couple of federal agents corner her and say, no, 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 it's a real Brazilian river monster. And she says, no, no, it's Christian Bale. And in my script, one of the federal agents says, Christian Bale is currently in rehearsals to do a Broadway musical based on American Psycho called Psycho! Exclamation point. And Taylor wrote back in the margins, shouldn't it be Bateman Begins? And I'm like, my God, that's a much better joke than I had. That is a fantastic fucking joke. And I love that you came up with it. And, you know, all that to say, it's like, if you don't listen to the letterer when he has a better joke.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Putting your ego aside, though, right? Like, then you got to do that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, a guy like Taylor, if Taylor makes a suggestion, like he is doing it for a reason. You know what I'm saying? Like he's not a guy that is going to send you 15 pitches of script. It's like again, when the artist you trust pushes back, he or she they're pushing back for a reason, and even if you do not immediately understand it or see it, you need to all stop. And figure out what the issue is or figure out why this is going to be better because it is usually going to be better.
Why is Ben Bishop drawing 6-panel grids when I didn't put that in the script? It's like, okay, he had a reason to do it. And now I get why it's there. And, you know, that's helpful. And that's a big, I do want to circle back to one thing when we're talking about owning your own shit.
Oh, yeah. We went.
And this. The central importance of owning your own IP. I have been joking for years that like when you're handed the Monopoly board as a kid and you're setting it up, someone needs to tell you, this game is trying to tell you something about how capitalism works. Yeah. And what it's trying to tell you is if you don't own shit, you are fucked. If it's about just collecting your $200 every time you go around the board, you're doomed.
You're gonna be paying a lot of rent.
You need to own your own thing that people have to pay you for when they use it. And if you do not own your own thing, you're fucked. So you'd better own your own thing.
Make money while you sleep.
And way too many of these publishing companies are about grabbing people's fucking Boardwalk and Park Place is what they
are,
and collecting rents off of it. That's what they are, and they're not all like that. There's still a few good ones, but that is the main problem. When we go back to this question, like, why do we go into business for ourselves? It is like, you know, that's why. It's because, you know, there is very little that a lot of these publishers can offer us. Particularly now when we can, it didn't used to be that we could go directly to the consumer, you know. Now we can, and we can make more money doing it. We keep our rights. Like, I don't know what they have to offer us. And the thing I never got out. So I was talking to this guy who, again, he's involved at a big publishing company. He's about to leave, go into business for himself, all of that stuff. And he was talking about the 80-20. He didn't call it the 80-20. I thought that was a brilliant thing that you said, Ray. And he's talking about the 80-20, and he's like, okay, so 80% of my business is going to be on Kickstarter. And he had a really great business model for Kickstarter, where it's like, he hears about all these people, I'm going to do 10 campaigns a year and blah, 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 blah. And the 10 campaigns, when you do that, they kind of start to cannibalize themselves. Like, you can do six campaigns and probably make the same amount of money that you would doing 10 campaigns. But he's like, I want to do three or four campaigns a year. That's it. Yeah. And he had this plan where it's like, I'm going to do them this way, so I make more money per each thing. And that's going to do it. He's like, but so the other 20% of the business is I need to keep my name in the distributor catalogs. I need to keep my name in the comic shops. And that is what is, you know, that is what's going to fuel the Kickstarter business. Oh, he's the guy that did this. He's the guy that was nominated for an award because of this. He's the guy that was written up, you know, in CBR because of this. But the interesting thing about that 20% of the business was he considered it a write-off. He's like, I am not going to make a dollar doing this. I'm going to produce these things. I'm going to hand them off to a publisher. I'm going to try like hell to keep my rights. So that means that I'm going to have to make compromises otherwise. He's like, I am not going to make a dime doing these. This is almost like a promotional expense for me. I'm writing off those books, the money from those books, and I'm going to make all my money on these four Kickstarter campaigns. And I thought it was so interesting. And so that is an interesting thing. But about your 80-20 thing is what is so, I mean, maybe 5 years ago, it was 80-20, but it was the other way.
Yeah,
right? It was like, it was
the other way.
Yeah. And I think specifically for you, where it was like, 80% of my work is coming from DC, Marvel. I'm going to eventually, you know, I'll do a little bit for this company, a little bit for that company. Yeah. And then every once in a while, I'll drop a Kickstarter book and I'll make, you know, And it's so interesting. I mean, COVID poured gasoline on the fire and all of these things. But now, man, that 80-20 switched so quick.
There's a reason for that. I mean, because we've been watching the publishers, all of us have been watching what they've done, what they didn't do. We watch the market. I mean, we already got the news about Diamond. So you see things are changing. And, you know, every 20 years-ish or so, there's always a talk about, oh, comics are dead or comics are dead. Comics have been dying for 80 years, man.
Yeah.
And then something happens and then we get a surge and then something happens because it changes like life, like we change, you know? And comics adapts because everybody wants to read stories. If you talk to two different people about the comics market, you're going to get two different answers. Some people are killing it. And some people are like, I got to get out of here. You know, I'm going to go work at Walmart. You know what I mean? Like, two different answers, man. But you have to figure out how that's going to work for you. And you have to figure out why you are here. And I know I'm going to sound like every guru on Instagram or whatever, but you do have to understand what your why is. You know, why are you here? You know, some people are here to try to make money. you're dead. Go work at Walmart.
Yeah, right? terrible choice.
Terrible choice. That's not a motivation. Mm-mm. That's a cherry on the cake, right? Like, if you know you're doing Drawing Blood, and you know gets picked up, and it's almost rivaling, you know, Turtles. It's not because that was your plan. I'm just saying. Yeah. That's not even Kevin's plan.
Yeah.
It's just that's how it turned out. I mean, speaking of that, like Kevin and Peter, they were doing a joke. It was just a joke. Yeah. It's a billion-dollar joke, but it's a joke.
Well, and I've told this story before, but I read that first issue, and I was enough of a comics fan at the time that when someone asked me how it was, I said, "Well, it's this funny parody of the Frank Miller Ninja books."
Yes.
Ronin and what he's doing in Daredevil and all that. And it's also got a little bit of the Teen Titans, New Mutants, you know, teenagers with superpowers thing. It's got a little bit of a Chris Claremont vibe to that.
Yep.
And I said, I don't know that anyone is interested in a comic book that's a parody of these other trends in comic books. And the forest for the trees that I missed is it's cute animals doing martial arts, man.
Yes! That's,
no one gives a shit about Klaus Janson references. That's not, we're not here because that rooftop looks like a Frank Miller rooftop and that's a little funny. We're not here because the hand has turned into the foot and Stick is now Splinter.
What?
Like, it's the simplest, goofiest parody in the world, but the forest for the trees is it's cute animals who are universally adaptable to your audience.
Yes.
You know,
my wife was
one of the early conventions we were at with Kevin. My wife was looking at the multiracial, multi-ethnic line waiting to see Kevin. And she turned to me and she went, "Turtles are green. Why the hell did that never occur to me before? Like, there's no, you can't identify with Leonardo because you're not it." It's like, no, anybody can identify with Leonardo. Yeah. Anybody who's the party kid can identify with Mikey. Anyone who's the serious rap too tight kid can want to be with Raphael. You know, exactly. Can want to be
with Raphael. An attitude. Everybody's got that friend who's got an attitude.
I don't know if you saw. There's a hilarious interview with Scarlett Johansson.
Oh yeah, I saw it because she is attracted to Raphael. Turtles.
She's like, "I dated nothing but Raphael my entire life." And then the interviewer goes, "And you married Mikey?" And she goes, "Yep, yes! I totally married."
Yes.
You know, she married a guy from Saturday Night Live. You know, she didn't marry the brooding. She's happy because she abandoned her love of Raphael.
And now she gets
and found happiness with Mikey. But like the fact that even someone like Scarlett Johansson, who you are not thinking of as a big pop culture, I would bet she has never read a Ninja Turtles comic in her life, and she's talking about the cartoon.
Cartoon, yeah.
That would be my guess. Because those characters, or she's talking about the 1990 movie characters.
Yeah. No, she's definitely talking about those cartoons.
She's like the right she's the right age for that. But it's like, that's how powerful those and when we created the pastiche, the Ragdolls, I thought a lot about, like, it's an interesting thing. When you create anything, you're always trying to create the best thing that you can create.
Yes. Whatever version that is.
Yeah. But when you're trying to create something that in the world of your story is universally beloved, there's sort of an additional pressure of, like, someone reading it has to believe, no, that would be really popular. That would sweep the world. Everyone would be interested in these cats that you know, are in these samurai cats. Everyone will read that comic, you know. And it's I did approach it a different way. I approached it from a more, an archetypal level in creating the characters. Mm-hmm. I always Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Mm. In no way did the writers who created Star Trek, that is a great example of something arising out of a group mind. There is no word in the Star Trek series Bible that says Captain Kirk represents the ego, the self, and Mr. Spock represents the superego who corrects, you know, who always has the right, the righteous idea or the logical idea. And Dr. McCoy is the id who is always going to bring the emotional idea. No one sat down and designed that, but that's absolutely what they ended up with, because writers approached those scripts and went, okay, I now want to have an argument between logic, between reason and emotion, mediated by the self. And that's every scene, every other, every Star Trek episode has the scene where Captain Kirk hears the argument between reason and emotion and has to weigh which is the correct answer, and usually finding the middle ground. So sitting down to create the ragdolls, I had to go like, what's as primal as that? And I went with mind, body, spirit, which is a variation of that. You know, there's the one that's all about her physicality. There's the one that's all about her mind. And there's the one that's all about her heart. And so that's the discussion. But I'd never done that before, where I was like really focused on archetypes and making something that would feel archetypal to the audience.
That's if you're looking for success, if you're looking for success, okay. So yeah, we're giving a masterclass, guys. So if you are looking for success, that is it, and that is everything. If you go on to TV Tropes, I think it's got 3-man team, 4-man team, and archetypes are everything. And what I find to be almost, I'm going to say it, imbecilic, is that,
great word.
No, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to be, you know, you're shooting yourself in the foot, because there's nothing different. What happens is the difference comes in execution, not the origin.
Yeah.
Right? Nothing here is original. What makes it original is execution.
Yeah.
Even twins, you dummy. Even twins aren't the same.
Right.
Like, it's how they live their lives.
No, I was thinking about this a lot recently, and I don't know if we want to wade into that minefield, but you know, in the wake of the Neil Gaiman stuff, some people have also taken this as an opportunity to talk about how derivative his work is of some previous work. And I don't know that all of that is, I don't think he's a one for one with Tanith Lee. I don't think that's true. But also, he's writing for DC Comics, and every single word Neil Gaiman writes for DC Comics is built on the backs of Alan Moore and Len Wein and the people who created the supernatural universe of DC that he is then riffing on successfully, smartly. But that's the whole, I was thinking about, you know, there's the writing we do that I call playing with the action figures, which is you're working on Spider-Man, working on IG-88, you know, which I've even done, you know, working on the characters and bringing what you can to them and saying what you want to say about the world through them. Yes. And then there's your completely original work. Now, somewhere in the very gray zone between that is that even your completely original work is going to rely on tropes, is going to rely on all of the, let me just get to the end of this thought. And the thing about you're always going to be using tropes. I have used the multiverse a lot. In my version of multiversal things, I do the lazy thing that everybody does, and there's a glowing portal that you step through and you're in another multiverse. Roger Zelazny, great fantasy sci-fi writer, in his books, in his Amber series, you traverse the multiverse with your mind by walking or riding a horse or driving a car, and in your mind, you change your surroundings into the universe that you're heading into. No one has ever done a multiverse thing like the Amber series. No one has ever done that precise version. And that's, to me, the holy grail. Is you go, I'm going to do a multiverse story. I'm going to come up with an approach. It's still a multiverse story. It's still parallel universes. It's still mirror, mirror on Star Trek. But the genius is going, everybody has done glowing portals, man. What can I do that's not glowing? What can I do that's not Doctor Strange going like this and stepping through it? And that's what we're all trying to do.
Exactly. Rylan. And wait. One more. This shout out goes to my best friend, Christopher Mitchell. Here is yet someone else who's read the Amber series. I'm still not going to read it. Someone else who I care about it. It's really great. That's a lie. I've read some of it. But when we were kids, he pushed it on me so hard.
That'll so kill hard. It.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was like, it. No. Anyway, sorry, Rylan. Go ahead.
No. Nobody's. I mean, all I was gonna say is I was just gonna drop. It. It's like Star Trek was fucking wagon train. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like we're dealing with Star Trek.
Yes.
We talk about stuff being derivative.
Look, I'm excited, guys, and I knocked my thing out. So hold on, so I can hear you. All right, here we go.
Go ahead.
And also, wagon train was what Roddenberry came up so that he could sell. Like, he was going to do literary science fiction on television, which hadn't really been done outside of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And his sales pitch was, no, it's a Western. It's Wagon Train. It's not Wagon Train at all. But, like, that's the thing you can sell, you know?
Yeah, but it's also Wagon Train. It is also a fucking Western.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so Ray is totally right, where it's like, there's nothing that's new, right? And you're always playing in someone else's sandbox, but nobody's going to play the way that you're going to play. And I mean, okay, so Star Trek was wagon train, but Star Trek dealt with a lot of stuff in a very serious way that no one had ever dealt with.
Right.
And the first interracial kiss on television, and all of these really important things that were amazing. But then the reboot of Battlestar Galactica was both Battlestar Galactica. And it was what Ronald Moore was already starting to do in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And so you're playing in the same exact sandbox as all of those things. However, it was its own thing. Like we had not seen people deal with religion in such a serious way on television. And again, you could do it because it was science fiction, right? It wasn't, we weren't talking about Catholics and Jews and we were talking about, you know, again, we're in a different place. We're in a different time. We're in all of these things. So that was interesting. The Orville is.
Oh, yes. I got to watch that.
A lot of people say like Orville is the best Star Trek show since it's not a Star Trek show, but it's a Star Trek show, but it's also doing its own thing. And so this is my point is that, well, you know, these things can, I mean, I think the best Star Trek thing I've seen in a very long time, I love Lower Decks. And I actually love Strange New Worlds. So I'm not sitting here, but the Black Mirror episode,
The USS Callister episode, yeah,
yes,
is incredible Star Trek, and so these things are derivative in a way, and it's easy for a cynical idiot to write these off as it's just this, but all of those things, they shine in their very own specific way, and there's room for all of them.
Yeah,
and there's a big inspiration for Star Trek, bigger than Wagon Train. That when I saw it when I was a kid, I was like, wow, I can't believe how much Star Trek borrowed from Forbidden Planet. Like, that's a... But again, and Forbidden Planet exists because someone wants to do a science fiction version of fucking Shakespeare's The Tempest.
Yeah.
And that's... So, like, even the original thing that the other thing is drawn very heavily from is like, no, that... But that spaceship crew was invented by Shakespeare in the Elizabethan era, you know, as guys that get shipwrecked on Prospero's Island in The Tempest. Like, so there's never not, and Shakespeare is also drawing from, you know, Romeo and Juliet is some other, you know, is a folk tale that he was aware of. It's someone else's play that he rewrites.
Tarantino stole from 100 different places for Pulp Fiction. But it is perhaps the most original film I've ever seen in my life. Nobody had ever put that kind of spin on the ball. Nobody had ever arranged those things in that way. It reminds me of Kempo, and Ray, you will appreciate this as a fellow martial artist. But Kempo is all of these puzzle pieces, and Ed Parker, the guy that founded Kempo. Kempo is very young. It was created, you know, basically in the 60s, right? And then it was built over time. But it took all of these puzzle pieces from other martial arts, right? And, we're going to grab this, and this is really effective, and this is really effective. And we're going to put them all together. And Kempo is this series of techniques where you take, so they settled on whatever it is, 200 puzzle pieces. That's an arbitrary number. I don't know what the actual number is. But it's like, okay, so this technique is, we took these five, puzzle pieces, and we put them together in this way. And this technique is, well, we kept two of those, but we grabbed these three other ones and we put them together this way. And they created all of these techniques, and they created this martial art, and they created these katas from all of these different puzzle pieces. And it is derivative in the best way. It took the best of what
really
hundreds, thousands of years of martial arts had to offer, and it put it together in a way that, and the beauty of it is that when you practice it, it's what I'm doing now is like, well, so you learn all of Ed's techniques. And then the further you get along, you're like, okay, well, go back to Ed's technique and figure out what your technique is. And it's like, well, I'm going to keep these three things that Ed did.
Yeah.
And I'm going to add wrestling, and I'm going to add jiu-jitsu, and I'm going to add, you know, a lot of Tang Soo Do. And then it becomes this other thing that is derivative, but it is very me. And it is very Ed.
You know what? That makes sense for, you know, it's funny. I don't want to turn this into a martial arts thing, but that seems like Kenpo is, because you're doing Kenpo now, right?
Tang Soo Do but yeah, I teach at a Kenpo dojo right now.
Well, to me, it's like, and it's, I love your analogy. It's so beautiful because it's like Ed Parker stuff. You can definitely see the Wing Chun in it. You can see, you know, Wushu. You can see a lot of borrowed stuff from Chinese martial arts. Some of the stronger stances in Kenpo, that's karate, right?
Yeah.
So, and I'm like, this is kind of beautiful, right?
Yeah.
It's very beautiful. I want to say Jeff Speakman is a practitioner of Kenpo.
Right? Yeah.
So
the perfect weapon himself.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. I mean, it's just one of those things, and that's to me what collaboration and originality is. It's the point of view,
yeah.
Right? Because me, you, and Abalone could make an entirely new Star Trek, but base it off of, I don't know, Chekhov. Like, it's all Chekhov's point of view.
Yeah.
Right? And then
I watch it.
I watch it. I've been thinking about it, obviously. But you mentioned Black Mirror, and I was going to say, Black Mirror, all I got to do is go to Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's just one of those things. And if you are able to let go of the pretense that you're going to make something, the idea of making something new versus making something you want to see.
Yeah.
It's a whole different
thing. And also, I would say that it's a thing in the development of artists. We all start out really just doing pastiches of the things we love. You know,
definitely.
everyone's first story is fan fiction. Everyone starts I wrote a James Bond script when I was 12 years old. Like, you know, everyone starts there. And if you're lucky, then years later you get to play in those fields, but you eventually develop your own point of view, and your own way of looking at things, and your own desires about what stories you can tell. I mean, I can honestly say, like, my publisher has, James Bond was my favorite franchise of any of those things growing up. And my publisher has had those rights for almost the whole time I've been writing for them. And I've never really cracked into it. And partly it's because I'm 59 years old now, and I've seen a lot of media. And the thing that I think I would have to pitch that would get approved by the James Bond license holders, I'm not interested in doing that.
Yeah.
The James Bond story, I know they would buy from me, bores me when I sit down to think about writing. Well, let me come up with a supervillain. Let me come up with a way to take over the world. Let me come up with, what is James, like, the last thing I pitched them was about James Bond's complicated relationship with suicide. Because that interests me. His first love in the books commits suicide. And a friend pointed this out to me, and it blew my mind that it hadn't occurred to me. The woman he falls in love with and later marries in the books and in the movies is a woman he interrupts in the act of suicide and saves her life. And the idea that, like, no, he loves Tracy because I can fix what went wrong with Vesper. I can live in a world where I save Vesper and she doesn't bleed to death in a shower. I carry her out of the ocean and she lives. I can make a, that's very literary and that's very psychologically interesting. And I pitched the thing where James Bond commits suicide. And I'm like, I know they're going to love this. And it's like, no, they're not. And they don't want to make it. But that's the story that I'm interested in with that character.
Yeah.
As
opposed to,
As opposed to Blofeld has another secret base and he's got a rocket that's going to destroy London. Yeah. And, you know, like, those stories can be great. It's just 59-year-old me no longer. I no longer want to really write that exact story without it having something else going on in it.
I think you write that story.
I was wrong. Like, name. Yes.
No. Yeah.
I'm so with that. Carter or whatever.
And I've done stuff like that. In the last year, I got a chance to actually write a version of a public domain James Bond named Nick Carter. Mm. So there was Nick Carter was an incredibly popular character in the 19th century in magazines and penny dreadfuls, moved into the pulps. They made movies, they made a serial, and then eventually died out in the 50s. In the 60s, they asked my father to basically reinvent him as James Bond. And last year, I wrote a short story where I basically wrote, how are those the same guy, though? The guy from the private eye from the 19th century and the detective from the 20th century are supposed to be the same guy. How'd that work?
Right.
And that was an interesting story for me to write. I'm not interested in writing a Nick Carter super spy story, and I'm not interested in writing a Nick Carter 19th century detective story. But I was able to close the gap and write it.
Yeah, you found that connection that
but
worked.
But that's
for
the
you.
You know, we all you're always looking for. What do I have to say about this? What's my way in? You know,
well,
and
that's
be a struggle with some characters.
Well, I get it. I mean, that's how I ended up with the main thing about Midnight Tiger. So Gavin Shaw is this kid who loves superheroes and he knows the stories and he's all into this thing. But he doesn't necessarily want to be the thing. He just enjoys that arena. It's like somebody who loves sports but never wanted to really play sports.
Right.
And appreciates that. But then you get an opportunity to do this, but he also lives in the neighborhood very much like any urban neighborhood where, oh yeah, if this black kid plays basketball or baseball, he's going to get a contract and then they're going to pick him up. He's going to go to a different state and make a lot of money and then move his family and all this kind of stuff. What about his neighborhood that he could actually help that's in, you know, turmoil? That story doesn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
Not really. Like Black Lightning stayed there in the original run. He didn't join the Justice League or any of that stuff until much later, right? But his whole thing was, here's a guy who gets these powers. It's all in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, Gavin Shaw is a kid who gets his powers as a legacy, even through accident. And the call is, well, when this main hero dies, because they've bequeathed their power to you and they're on a team, then it is your right. You know, you get ushered onto the team. And Gavin's like, I don't think so. Because we have so many problems here that I could actually help. Why would I leave here? Because now, you know, I have power.
Right.
To me, it's an allegory for why would I not help people in my community now that I'm a star.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's it is such an interesting thing because it's like, I mean, we do that all the time, right? We can't wait to get, I mean, I grew up in Detroit. I couldn't wait to get out of there. I never looked back, you know, and too many of us do that. Too many of us who have the power to help to change things, we leave. And you know, we were so traumatized by what we went through that we don't think that, well, there are still kids back there being traumatized. And we could go back and do something about that. I mean, I think that is so interesting. And then it's also, we very quickly lose sight of the micro because we get focused on the macro. It's like, well, there's this whole world for me to tackle. And you know, the best Daredevil stuff there's this huge thing going on in Manhattan, New York City, and we gotta, and it's like, yeah, but Hell's Kitchen.
Yes, right,
like,
right.
That's the thing is like, well, you know, and particularly when you came from someplace that means something, where it is this community and this ecosystem. And I guess they're all like that to a degree, but I think when you come from Compton, when you come from Detroit, when you come from Hell's Kitchen, it is a very specific thing. Right. I mean, I think that's pretty revelatory.
And quick shout out to Tony Isabella, my friend Tony, who created Black Lightning.
Yes.
Lovely, lovely man. Very talented comics writer. Yes. But yeah, no, we are all products of where we came from. And you know, it is inevitable that you'll write about that, that Star Wars is about Marin County, Star Wars is about being a kid trapped in Marin County who does not necessarily want to be in a small town in Marin County driving up and down the strip, all the time, and who likes driving real fast. That's who has a thing for speed. That is in all of his work, and that's, and you can like when there's no blood in the work, it shows, it's boring and no one cares. If there's nothing of you in it, and that's why, it's very common writing advice, but I think it's so true. It's like, you got to have a life. Yes, read all the books, see all the movies, read all the comics, but go out and do shit, talk to people, have experiences, have adventures,
touch grass, as the kids say.
Touch grass, as the kids say nowadays.
It's what I say to anybody who's thinking about a film school. I mean, there's certainly great things to, great things to get out of a film school, and you need to learn the actual craft somewhere. But usually somebody's going into college and it's like, well, what is your advice? I want to get into film. It's like, well, study anything but film. Study psychology, study sociology, study art history, study, almost anything else. And figure out what you want to write about. Prepare yourself to write, intellectually about something in a meaningful way. I think that is the best thing.
College, I stumbled backwards into taking classes with this one professor who was, for want of a better, it started as like, you have to take a science course. So I took the history of science, no math in that course. And the professor on the very first day, this is why I ended up taking six classes with the guy. He says, and he was named Peter Skiff. He had the voice of a 1950s science fiction movie NASA scientist. Since high school, you kids have been sold a bill of goods. And the bill of goods is that over here you got the humanities and over here you got the sciences. And they're two very different things and they're not connected. If I do anything for you kids, I'm going to teach you that they are like this. And you can't take them apart from each other. And years before Steve Martin wrote Picasso at the Le Pan Agile, he was the guy that told me cubism and atomic theory need each other. You need Picasso painting like that for Niels Bohr to do what Niels Bohr does in the laboratory, for Einstein to there's a thing happening in human thought at the same time. And it makes Picasso paint people a certain way. And it makes Einstein come up with the theory of relativity. And it's because of a thing that's in the air that everyone is breathing, and knowing what those things are and reacting to them and knowing that you're subject to them, is a big thing.
I was going to say, I have a big beef with them taking the arts out of schools. It's the first to go. And then they wonder why test scores drop.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta, and again, it goes both ways. The purpose of sending, I was there to study film. The purpose of making sure the film kid takes the history of science class is, again, what are you going to write about? How do you understand the world? What is the world? To the degree, my college didn't have minors, but to the degree that there was one, mine would have been epistemology, the history of the development of ideas. And I think that's a hell of a thing for writers to study, because it's about cosmologies. It's about how did people see the world 100 years ago? How did people see the world 5,000 years ago? And how has that changed? And how has that changed? I always think that one of the things that period films always get wrong is they don't think about that psychology itself has changed. A good period film to me should feel like a science fiction movie where you're like, why are these people even behaving like this?
Yeah.
I don't
why,
like,
why do they value these things?
Why
do
yeah,
they,
yeah. Why is that important to them in a way that that would never be important to me? Because that stuff absolutely changes. You know, I was when I enjoyed watching The Crown for all of the pro-monarchist propaganda it was. But I turned to my wife at one point and I said, you know, this is a great show. I really like it. And the stakes in almost every episode are, pardon me, old man, but you seem to be using the wrong fork. Like, you know, the, it's all about just like protocol that nobody should ever have given a shit about, but they did. Downton Abbey was particularly like every episode was, pardon me, old shoe, but you've used the wrong fork. And let's be angry about that for 50 minutes. Least surprising thing in the world to find out the guy who created Downton Abbey was pro-Brexit. It's like, of course you are, man.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you are like pretending to be mildly critical of the way things used to be, but you wish you had servants, dude, and you are not fooling me into thinking you don't wish you had servants. There should be an Irish gentleman cleaning my car, shouldn't there? In a fair world, I'm British. I shouldn't have to do that. But anyway, it's like, yeah, we, you know, fish, you're a fish writing about water, and it's hard to be a fish writing about water because you don't know anything else. It's what you're swimming in, but it's the trick is hold your breath for a second and go, what am I breathing? What am I swimming in? What would happen if I just fall to the ground, you know?
Right.
You know, yeah,
write about things that we take for granted all the time. Yeah. Some of the best stories. If you can have anybody who is a consumer of your work walk away with a new way of thinking about a thing, you're winning.
That's everything.
Yeah.
That is my favorite thing to hear is I never looked at it that way. I never.
Yeah.
Tied for that with my favorite thing to hear is you made me want to be a writer.
Oh, yeah. That's always good.
That's a great one to hear. You made, you know, you changed my life. I felt a thing that I hadn't felt. And it complicates the argument about censorship in a way, because a very smart screenwriter once said, a guy who wrote Midnight Run said, you can't say this art ennobles me without also admitting there's art that doesn't ennoble you. Right. There's art that brings you down. There's art that makes your life worse and makes you think things that maybe you shouldn't be thinking. Like, you do have to be aware of that. And I also think that's part of the responsibility of this, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
We're pouring shit into people's brains. What do we want to pour into their brains?
Well, and here's the thing is it's never been more important, our station and all of this, because we do not have conversations anymore. You know, there's no exchange of ideas. We are terrified of people who disagree with us. Yes. We do not want to listen to anyone, and we line up on our sides and we shout and nobody ever. And now, you know, that's what Twitter used to be. It's like, okay, well, I'm over here and you're over here and we're going to stand here and we're going to shout at each other. There's no listening. There's no actual exchange of ideas. And now it's getting worse because, like, well, everybody on this side has stayed on Twitter. Everybody on this side has moved off of Twitter and gone somewhere else. And so now, and the way the algorithms are, period, we only hear stuff that backs up the ideas that we already have in our head. And there are very little ideas being exchanged. There's very little gray area talk. There's very little meeting in the middle. There's none of this, but it all happens in art. It is like, it is the one place where a guy on this side and a gal on this side can come together and consume the same words and entertain them. And actually, even if they don't even understand it, they can be affected by them. They can be changed by them. And it's funny because it's like, we all want it to be, this is a Zen metaphor that gets used a lot, where like people think that enlightenment is like getting hit with a bucket of water. We're just immediately drenched. All of everything we need to know about life is dumped into our brains and it stays there and it's wonderful and we are changed. We want debate to be like that. We want to be shouting our ideas on Twitter, and we want the idiot on the other side to be like, oh shit, I get it now. I'm drenched. I'm changed. Let me come on over there. That is not what's going to happen. It is, and if you spend all your days throwing buckets of water at people, it's not going to change shit. Nobody's going to get wet. And so how enlightenment actually happens in a Zen sense is they say it is like walking through fog. And the air is saturated with the water, and you don't even realize that you're walking through the water, and slowly but surely you are picking up wisdom and insight and enlightenment. And then at some point you look down and you're like, holy shit, I am drenched. I didn't even realize it. And so, and so we are the fog. And it is the only way to get at these people right now. If we're trying to hit them with buckets of water, they're really good at ducking hoses at buckets of water. We have to saturate the fucking air. We have to saturate the art with our ideas. With the ideas that will make this world a better place, right? That will foster compromise and hope and all of this stuff. This is the only place where people will willingly walk into the fog. And maybe it's because they don't even realize they're walking into the fog, but it's there, man. And this is the only place that meaningful discussion is happening right now.
I feel that strongly. Like, and it's everything you're saying. Everybody here knows Barbara Dillon. And I recently, we met up, we had a great chat and everything. We talked about this, like we need allies. You know, we need allies in really helping to combat this era of, I'm not listening to you because my opinion is the best opinion. And if your opinion isn't mine, then we cannot connect. We're not friends, or you're the enemy in most cases. And that is, you know, it's so wrong. Because everything that we are as a society, as a race, has been built on sharing ideas. Everything. And we are, especially here in America, and I'm going to say something fairly controversial here, and usually I don't say things controversial, as you guys know, but segregation is still here.
Oh, yeah.
And but it's been... The internet has made it pervasive. Not the internet, social media. Social media has made it pervasive because everybody's choosing sides, but it's like if you've played a tabletop role-playing game, this is like a 25, 23-sided die, right? There's not the good guys and the bad guys anymore, and it never really is. It never, you know, there's a lot of gray, but that group thinks they're right, and that group thinks they're right. Like, I mean, to bring it back to comics, you know, Magneto thinks that he's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's perspective. And if you're not willing to listen, that's fine. That's why I love what Ryland was saying, because in my comics, I don't beat people over the head with ideas. I make sure they have fun. And I sneak in messages. Right? Right. That's what I do. But my message is one of hope. My message is one of positivity.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the message is. It's called let's communicate. Let's talk. There's other examples of different ways. Like my wife and I talk about us and coming together in our marriage. She comes from a family that has a certain ideas and I had different ideas. The idea is that each idea has a validity to it, but what works best here now, right? Which one is the better idea? And you have to be willing to say, no, actually that one's better. And it doesn't have to come from you. It shouldn't have to come from you, because what is it? Like, you can have emotion. I just found out, my wife again. You can have emotion and you can have progress, but you cannot have both.
Interesting.
Right? So if you're stuck in ego land, but you want to move forward by, let's say, I'm going to use Ryland. You know, I want you to write some stuff about these ideas, blah, 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 whatever. And you're kind of like, this is cool, but you know, we could do this better. Well, my emotion is I don't want to listen to Robert because this is my shit. You know what I mean? I don't want to listen to them. And then I do it my way, and then the book bombs. And then somebody in a review goes, yeah, if they did it, blah, 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 and it's exactly what Ryland says, I have not made progress because my ego got in the way. My emotions about that got in the way. And now, you know, I'm sheepish here. But in today's era, I would be like, they're wrong and Ryland's right. They're all wrong. You know, I mean, that's really the thing, man. Like, I want more. I know that we are capable of more.
Yeah.
You know, we are capable of more. And I think that's our job. I think our job as creators is to inspire people and to remind them that they are capable of more.
Yeah. So. And to increase their empathy for people who are not them.
Yes, so much.
Or not like them.
So much so.
To open up the world to them where they can realize that people who don't look like them, sound like them, who aren't from where they're from. Again, it's that segregation you're talking about. But it's, you know, art can, you know, it's the reason why repressive states hate art so much.
Yes.
There's a thing about, there's a theory I have about conservative thought that I call the weak hand theory, which is the reason they don't want their kids to even know gay people exist is the idea that, well, if they know that's an option, they might take that option. It's like, you know what? They're going to take that option whether they saw an episode of Will and Grace or not, man. Like,
right.
But that episode of Will and Grace might actually make them feel better. Make them feel human, might make them feel seen. And that's what we do for people.
Avalonius, even better. I love your Will and Grace analogy because it's the same people who are telling him not to watch that episode of Will and Grace. If they watched it, maybe you'd get some insight as to why it's fine.
Yeah.
And then your relationship with your kid will be better.
Yeah. You spend 5 minutes with anyone and it's going to change your mind. They're human beings. This is a person who is wonderful.
Going back to Brexit, like they did a poll after the voting, and they discovered that the people who voted strongly anti-immigrant were people who lived in small villages where everyone was English. Hmm. The people who voted pro-immigrant lived in heavily immigrant neighborhoods in London. You know, heavily immigrant neighborhoods in Glasgow, heavily like if you are around people, you're not afraid of them and you realize they're people and they're great people.
Yeah.
It can happen so quickly. And you talk about that segregation. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, and in Detroit, you know, you were either black or you were white. And if you're white, you lived in a white neighborhood. If you're black, you lived in a black neighborhood and you stayed in your neighborhood. And there was so much fear and so much all of this stuff. And my world was about this big. You could fit it on a fucking postage stamp, right? And a ton of the people I grew up with are still there, and they're still stuck in that fucking postage stamp. I got lucky, went to the University of Michigan, and day one, I am in a room with a guy who's half Colombian, half Brazilian, and a practicing Muslim from DC. The two guys across the hallway are Indian. The guy next door is Korean, and it took about, I don't know, like 3 minutes for my world to you know, it was like the big fucking bang, you know.
But it's the thing. It is very difficult to maintain a provincial racist attitude in that dorm.
Yes,
right. Because 100%. It won't be tolerated. Yeah. By the way.
Yeah. Right.
Which is a good thing. It's good to be intolerant. I mean, it's called
It's very much so good to be intolerant.
Yes. It's literally called the paradox of intolerance for that reason. Intolerance is the one thing we must all be intolerant and unforgiving and you got to let people know. No, you should be ashamed.
Yes,
you should be ashamed that you feel that way, and it's fine. Just in honor of the great David Lynch, I will repeat: fix your hearts or die.
That's, no, but that's but, a piece but, of but, advice. But, yeah, but it, yes. is another, it is another thing you have to learn. you have to learn that that is not okay. Because like, if you are taught your whole life that it's okay and that this is important and you got to cling to this, that this is one of the things that defined you. Like not everybody, you know, we punish people for having that shit loaded onto their hard drive. Right.
Yeah.
And here's the thing is at some point you are making the choice to commit to that program or not. And if you make the choice, if you wake up every day and you commit to that choice, then there is a problem. If when you are young and this is what is loaded onto your hard drive and you are sent out into the world, like somebody needs to take you in and give you a big fucking hug and say, hey man, the world's not like this. You don't need to hold on to this anymore. Right. Yeah. And then somebody needs to give you the opportunity to change. Right. We too often do not give people the opportunity to change. If someone gives you the opportunity or 10, maybe 10, 15, 20, 100 times gives you the opportunity to change and you double down on fucking nonsense, then that's on you. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly. Oh no, go ahead.
I was just going to tell a story quickly about, you know, in the world of comedy, there's a lot of, in the past particularly, there's a lot of, I'm going to do this joke, which is ironically racist, ironically sexist, ironically homophobic. But the thing is, your audience, who isn't your best friend, does not know that you don't really feel that way. I have a friend who's one of the funniest people I've ever met. He's not a racist, particularly, you know. And he was telling me once, we were having a conversation. I have a great revulsion for the Confederate flag, for obvious reasons. He told me that once he bought a pickup truck from an old white guy and it had a little Confederate flag decal on the back. Because he's a cosmopolitan comedy white guy, he thought it was funny and ironic that he had this. Everybody knows it. Like, all my friends are black. Everyone's going to laugh when they see that I have this truck with a Confederate flag on it. He said, well, I was driving cross country and I was filling up my pickup truck. And I noticed the old black guy at the next pump was just glaring at me. And I went, what's his fucking problem? And he's like, and then I went around the back of my truck to pump my gas and went, the fuck is wrong with me?
Yeah.
He doesn't know me. He doesn't know this is ironic. This is the symbol of oppression and murder. And I shouldn't fucking be driving around with a symbol of oppression and murder because it's funny. It's not funny. The audience doesn't know that's funny, that I'm being ironic with my fucking Confederate flag. And he chipped it off his car. And, you know, like, again, that is not a story about a perfect human being, but that is a story about, like, a man learning a fucking lesson the hard way. He could have learned it with a punch in the face if it was a different guy filling up it. The other pump could have been a much worse response.
He could have just been like,
Instead of just grumbling cracker motherfucker on his breath, you know, like it could have been, you know, it could have been something way, way worse, but instead it was just, oh, I'm an asshole for doing this and I shouldn't be an asshole. And yeah, like I've done not that joke. I would never do that, but we've all done jokes that are easy shots like that. And then you go, you know, it's time to take that fucking shit out of my repertoire. It's not, the audience doesn't know. There's a book by Kurt Vonnegut called Mother Night, and in the introduction he says, you know, I don't know the moral of many of the stories that I've written. I don't think about that, but this one has a moral, and I know it, and I'm even going to tell you in the opening chapter. And it's about the book's about a German radio broadcaster in the 1930s. He's married to a beautiful German actress and Nazism comes and he's like, I should get out of here. I should take my beautiful wife and get out of here. And he's approached by the OSS and told, no, 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 stay in Germany, stay on the radio. We're going to give you secret codes that you're going to read out that's going to be heard by Allied agents all over Europe while you're broadcasting from Nazi Germany. And of course, then the war ends. He can't find the OSS agent that hired him. And he's arrested as a Nazi war criminal. Wow. And the moral of the book is, we are who we pretend to be. So we must be very careful who we pretend to be. And I have taken that moral, like, it's like, No, don't be ironically racist, man, because you're just being racist. Don't be ironically homophobic, because 99% of the people that see you write that don't know you. They don't know your heart.
One of the principal markers of
why hurt those strangers with your words, because they don't get it. Like, that's
One of the principal markers of intelligence is the ability to pick up on sarcasm, on irony, all of these things. Here's the thing, is that the lion's share of people, maybe not Mensa candidates, right? So the ability of average Joe to pick up on the subtleties of your humor and all of that stuff is nil. And they pick up none of it. Yeah. And so when you put something out there, you gotta, and subtext is great. It's great to, you know, play to the more intellectually savvy, out there. However,
but it's also like everything else in the world. It's know your audience.
Don't make it a puzzle. Don't make it a puzzle.
It's know your audience. A joke you tell on Twitter to 12,000 followers is not a joke you tell at a cocktail party to three people who know you very, very well.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, that's a very different, and what you put in your art, you know, is, you know, there's a famous quote about, you know, I think it was Truffaut said, you can't make an anti-war movie because it's just going to look cool. Firing a machine gun looks cool. I don't care if it's in your anti-war movie. It looks cool. You know, and Spielberg thought Saving Private Ryan was an anti-war movie. It's like, that movie's a fucking recruiting poster.
Yeah.
Because it says that military sacrifice in wartime is a brave, noble, and beautiful thing worth celebrating. That ain't an anti-war movie, Steve. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the message that military service is good and vital and honorable and all of those things. My father fought in that war and he was proud of it, and I'm proud of him for fighting in it. That's not the point. The point is that it's very difficult, you know, it's very difficult to make Goodfellas and really sell. No, these people are all losers.
Yeah.
They're all incredible losers. And
they're the bad guys.
Really hard to make that point. But Marty still thinks those guys are cool, and you'll never get he will never let go of that. You know,
he did it again. He did it again with Wolf of Wall Street.
And, the worst.
And
that's a movie that absolutely does not know what it's trying to say. Except I really miss cocaine. That, like, the I got from that movie was Marty going, "Holy shit, cocaine was so fucking great, and I can't believe I don't do it anymore."
Yeah, but it's Fight Club also, where it's like, we are trying to send the message that, like, that this road leads nowhere, and the message that, again, those non-Mensa candidates take from it is like, wow, this is really awesome. We need to get a bunch of guys together and fight in a basement. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Well, and part of the problem comes from it's aesthetics.
You know how to sell a movie.
Yeah. And how you sell a movie is that Brad Pitt is Tyler Durden. You know, if Ed Norton is Tyler Durden, it doesn't look cool to be in Fight Club. It looks kind of nerdy and dumb to be in Fight Club if it's Ed Norton.
It's like a try hard. It's like totally try hard.
It's like, as an example, the example of Saving Private Ryan, Spielberg can't help himself. He's a visual storyteller. And so in his supposed anti-war movie, I don't know if you like how recently you've seen that movie. Every German soldier that is encountered in that movie looks like a monster from outer space. They're all 6'4" and they all have these hawk noses and deep set eyes. He can't help himself. He has to cast gargoyles to play Nazis because Nazis are monsters. But the truth of the matter is they all looked like Matt Damon. That's what a Nazi generally looks like, Matt Damon. He doesn't look like an outer space gargoyle, you know. And if you want to make an anti-war
movie, the Eagle from the Muppets.
Yeah, and if you want to make an anti-war movie, Tom Hanks is gunning down hundreds of guys who look like Matt Damon, and the audience is going, "Ooh, those are just 18-year-old kids. What the hell, man?" I was like, "Well, they got the wrong color uniform on, so this is what we do to them." You know, that's an anti-war movie, but that is very hard for people to want to make. Sam Fuller once asked if The Big Red One was an anti-war movie. And he said, you can't make an anti. He's like, there's no such thing as a realistic war movie. If I hide behind the screen with an M1 rifle and shoot the guy sitting next to you, then in the movie theater, then I'm making a realistic war movie. But like, without me murdering half the audience before you leave the theater, there's no such thing as a realistic war movie. But anyway, we've slid as usual into 1,000 different topics.
Like I said, when we at the top of this, like we could ramble on about anything.
But
so anyway, I don't call it anything. I think this is very intelligent, rousing, and often rowdy conversation between friends is what this is.
It's why we do the show, you know, is they have discussions like these. This was the whole conceit.
Ray, as we wrap up, remind people where they can find you on the internet, where they can find news about Studio Sky Tiger, etc.
Follow me at R.A. Height. Just type in R.A. Height or Ray Anthony Height and all my socials, everything about me comes up. Lately, Google has been cutting off my first name and just putting Anthony Height, which is my son, who is also, you know, like a basketball guy. So, you know, 5'6" dunker. Wow. So he will also come up.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's the old guy is me. If it says comics, it's me.
Another way to defeat bad Google results, by the way, because they're using AI for everything now, is on that top link, it says all. And if you scroll down, one of them says web.
Of
your choices. If you choose web instead of all, it throws out the AI search results and you generally get a better, just a helpful internet tip from your friends at the Writer's Block.
Yeah. Of course, these wonderful people with the beautiful information
get you exactly where you need to go. We try to help. And Ryland, where can the kids find you online?
I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so now I have to spell it for you. You will also see a number of Half Evil Comics accounts on all your favorite social media sites. So you should make sure to follow also. You are watching us on our brand new YouTube channel, many of you. So make sure you subscribe. Tons of new content. We'll have some breakout videos with Ray and, you know, some hot takes from Avalone and I on certain things. All kinds of fun stuff. So smash the subscribe button, smash the like button, and tell a friend. This was a great
And feel free to comment, by the way. We've opened up comments these things now.
Oh, yeah.
For a long time, we were like, But now we do want to hear from you. We want to hear from anyone who's willing to sit through one of these entire episodes and see what you think about all of these various topics, what art can do for you, how it has opened your mind, et cetera. Feel free to join the chat and talk to us about it. Anyway,
Let us know what else you want to see on the channel too. That's a great thing. Go ahead, Avalone. Sorry.
Yeah. And I'm very easily Googleable. Right now you're looking at the spelling of my name. Into your search engine, click web, and you will find all of my social media, my website, my ridiculous IMDb page, etc. And look for Drawing Blood number 7 coming soon, and Savage Tales, and if you're in the Southern California Avenue, the Southern California or Long Island, New York area, feel free to come out and see me at a con. That's it for this exciting episode of The Writer's Block. Thank you so much.
No, it's not it. It's not it.
It's not it. You got question. One more? Sure, go ahead.
Which one of you is the evil one if it's half evil?
I will let people decide that in the comments.
I think. How did I know you're going to say that?
Yeah.
Only people who are evil will say that. Anyway, question question answered.
Yeah, I think we all know. But anyway, thank you so much, Ray, for being on. Always a pleasure. And look forward to seeing you out in the real world sooner rather than later. Take care, everyone. Thanks for watching.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.